Kurt Vonnegut has passed away. Kurt Vonnegut wrote a book called Slaughterhouse Five. Did you ever read that?
Was like required reading, literally. And in my high school, I took a class called science fiction, and that was part of the curriculum.
Yeah, I remember that. Breakfast of Champions, I also read.
Mm-hmm.
Cat's Cradle, I didn't. He has died on Wednesday. He was 84 years old. He marveled that he had lived so long despite his lifelong smoking habit. And really what killed him is he fell a couple of weeks ago. Best-selling novels, he had 19. Also many short stories, essays, and plays. Slaughterhouse Five, which I have to reread, because do you remember anything about it?
Well, not. I remember it somewhat. I know it was about the bombing of Dresden, which he actually lived through. And this guy would time travel. He was, you know, one minute he's in this meat locker, which was Slaughterhouse Five, and the next minute he's on Tramfalgador or some planet.
It's listed as 18th on Modern Library's list of the 100 best novels of all time.
Wow.
He was obscure. In fact, I think he lived in the hills somewhere. I didn't talk about it in this article. He lived in the hills somewhere in New Hampshire. Of course I could be mistaken. Someone told me that he, when I lived up there, that he was... Yeah, he's way back out in the woods somewhere.
Eric came in this morning and said a strange thing to me. He said, I dreamed last night that Kurt Vonnegut died. And I said, well, yeah, he did. And he goes, I know. I said, well, you didn't leave your TV on because you don't have a TV.
He doesn't have a TV? Oh, come on, Eric.
I don't have a TV, and I really did have that dream. And then I sort of half woke up, and I thought, phew, he didn't really die. Because he's always been one of my heroes.
Oh, I could see that. You... It's time to make some money off of Eric. We got our own numbers guy here.
You haven't had a dream.
Let's get the police
about any of
us, in. Can you tell us where the bodies are?
No, but I did see Kurt Vonnegut speak when he came to Seattle last, and it was absolutely riveting. The guy is brilliant.
My motives are political, he once told Playboy magazine. I agree with Stalin and Hitler and Mussolini that the writer should serve his society.
Huh?
Good thing he didn't have a radio show on NBC in New York. I don't think you could say that there.
That's such an interesting thing to say. The writer should serve his society?
What exactly does that mean?
Well, it means that you should comment on what's going on in the world. For example, when he came to Seattle, he talked about how we need to essentially take a long, hard look at where our society is leading us.
That's all good, but the whole I agree with Stalin and Hitler and Mussolini part that sort of troubles me.
Wrong side
well,
of the bus.
Do they have some really great ideas that just got overshadowed by the whole putting people in ovens thing?
I think he was being ironic there.
Well, really? I mean, because didn't Stalin, Mussolini, and Hitler tell a writer to write what they wanted people to read, not what the writer thought was important? I mean, is that the irony there?
I think you might be right, because Leni Riefenstahl, for example, was an artist under Hitler who basically carried out the propaganda of the Third Reich.
He did say that writers should be, and biologically have to be, agents of change. It is your job to be a critic. It is your job to propose alternatives. On another occasion, he explained that his goal in writing novels was to catch people before they become generals and senators and presidents and poison their minds with humanity.
Oh,
love that.
Try to make them decent before they rise up in leadership.
I so agree with that, because the struggle for power itself has no soul. Just the urge to be powerful.
Right. It has no soul in that?
I don't know for sure. To me, the struggle for power would occur between me and a clerk at an auto parts store. But
is it vanity-based, a struggle for power? Is it always vanity-based?
You ever go into an auto parts store and there's always five people, and he has to decide which one was there first?
Mm-hmm.
It's very, it's like a world conflict with just five people.
Do you think that a struggle for power is vanity-based? To feel important?
Oh, yeah.
You mean the leaders like Castro?
Like you in an auto parts store. Is there vanity behind? Is that your motivating factor behind a struggle for power? Vanity?
I would say, and I'll bet Eric would back me up, that it comes out of instinctive survival you know, it's in our DNA
okay.
that those with power survive and those without the power essentially starve and can't reproduce.
Yeah, that's basically it. Those so, with power.
Simple as that.
So
I put
that,
the reproduce in there because that's the fun part.
That's somebody's attention.
Essential, too.
Yeah. Yeah.
Does that make you soulless? Is that a conflicting emotion with having a soul? Kurt Vonnegut said that, you know, the struggle for power is soulless.
Yes, I think that's what he means because, you know, if all you're about is gathering more food and nuts and women, you know, back then you guys didn't have any power, let's be honest.
Nah, it's fine.
You're working on it. But if all it was about was gathering as much, you know, hooter and grub mm-hmm. as you could, then there wasn't a whole lot of time for you to, like, develop real love.
Or a soul, about what was a sense of what was really important.
Right.
Cool.
And soul is a vague term? It's a pretty vague term.
It is a vague term because you can spin it to mean anything you want.
I think gathering hooters and nuts is a struggle for security, though. I mean, I'm all about the gathering and the hoarding, but I don't want the power. I think the power is where you want...
Yeah, but see, you got one nice pair of hooters.
Right.
You're happy with that.
And
you
don't want
a harem.
Refrigerator full of nuts. But I think power is where...
You're hoarding when it comes to the food thing.
Oh,
you want
yeah.
way more than you need.
I want security is why, not power. I think power is when you want to lord over people. You want people. You want to enforce your will on
right.
others.
More vanity. That's what I kind of think, too.
See, and I see power as someone who just works harder than you at gathering more of everything. They want to control. You'll feel that you're secure if you're with a group. Like if you're the gazelle at the back of the pack, and the lion will eat three or four other gazelles before it comes to you.
Now,
that's
many,
good enough for you.
Gazelle, by the way.
What supermodel?
Is it gazelle?
That's the supermodel. I like your analogy.
Gazelle, wasn't she right. that waitress on one of those 50 shows? I don't know. Do you know what I'm saying? You're with the safety in the herd thing, but there are some of us who feel that the herd doesn't know what the hell it's doing, and if I don't lead it, the whole herd is done for.
Vanity.
Where does leadership come from?
Vanity. Control.
It's not vanity.
I think it is. I like to be a leader, and it's because I'm vain, and I like to...
To think that the herd is lost without you, and that you need to lead the herd,
yeah.
or the herd
no,
will
to
die.
Think the whole safety of the herd depends upon me.
And that's a little bit of vanity. It doesn't mean it's negative. It just, it's...
Well, I don't interpret vanity as negative, but I'm not sure it is vanity. What do you think, Eric?
Well, it's also a little bit of, if it is to be, it's up to me. So you're...
Yeah, that's
you're,
a phrase, though.
Well, yeah, but you're wanting to take control
Boil
of
it
your...
down to a smaller than a bumper sticker. Where does leadership come from? I'd honestly, I'm just asking it off the cuff. I don't know.
It's really a desire for control, I think. You
well,
don't
it is. Of course it's a desire for control, but what is the underlying motivation, principle?
Well, that means you want to control it. In other words, you want to determine your own destiny and
you
don't trust.
The question I keep asking is why. I know what.
I think it's more than your own destiny because, I mean, I want to determine my own destiny, but I don't really have a big interest in the rest of the world's destiny.
You don't? What about your family and your daughter and all the people that
it's a small world.
Are in your sphere of influence?
And my community.
Right. So you are a leader, just... satisfied with being a leader of a small group.
Right.
An army of one.
What compels somebody to jump higher? What compels a guy like Al Franken, you know, who's got a pretty comfortable life, to say, I want to take, you know,
I want to be a senator.
I want to be in charge of a state here.
He wants to be an agent of change, as Kurt Vonnegut would have said, because he believes, and I'll tell you what I believe, because it's going to sound self-aggrandizing. Mm-hmm. There's just no way around it.
Okay. Just go for it.
I believe that leaders feel a sense of responsibility to all of humanity, and they want to do as much as they can to help others.
I'll buy that. It's noble.
I know. She doesn't trust that at all.
I don't trust that at all. Only because
I think.
Well, let me explain. I see a lot of. I think that can be true, but there are so many people that I've worked with in the past and that I've seen lead simply for
power.
For power and for attention. They don't give a crap about anybody
else. That brings it right back around to where we started with Kurt Vonnegut's great quote, and I'll repeat it again. He says that his goal in writing was to catch people before they become generals, senators, and presidents, leaders, and poison their minds with humanity so they would also have humanity with their leadership. So I guess you're right. There's some leaders, all they want is power, and maybe they don't even know why.
So I guess the first question we should ask every future leader on the campaign trail is, have you read Slaughterhouse-Five? And if they say no, then
whack 'em.
Watch out.
No, actually, they're going to be fast-tracked to four-star generalhood.
Mike in Paulsbo, hello.
Yeah, hey, Bob. I'm thinking self-pride. Pride. You know, the self-worth. You know what I'm saying? For leadership.
Self-pride.
Yeah.
It's ego.
Yeah.
That's vanity.
Okay.
Well, no, pride's good. Pride's important, of course.
Right.
The be all
I'm,
you can
I'm
be.
I'm sitting here on the way to work, and I'm trying to figure it out, you know, and I'm like, yeah, you know, because that's what I do, you know. I want to lead because I have pride. I have that ego, I guess.
How many people are under you, Mike?
Yep.
How many people are under you?
Right now, six.
Six people under you.
Yeah.
And do they respect you?
I hope so.
You kind of sort of know, right? I mean, I've seen them snicker behind my back.
Yeah, when they, you know, I hope they do. You know, I know that what I do, I know what I'm doing. And they know that.
Mm-hmm.
And they do look up to me to show them what's going on.
And you sound like you have a sort of a quiet integrity about you where you'd rather not discuss certain things. You'd rather just show by your actions that you are effective and you know what you're doing, and you'd rather proceed with confidence that they will follow because you've proven yourself, right?
Yes, yes. That is exactly right.
And it's not about how much glory you're getting, right?
Say again?
It's not about how much glory you're getting for doing the job, right?
Well, glory's not bad.
No. I'm just trying to nail this guy down. It's good.
Is it about the glory at all for you?
Not really. It's just, you know, being brought up on the East Coast, you had that pride. The work ethic, everything was bred into you.
A pride in the quality of what your effect is on others and your product and your profession.
Right.
Do you think that's lacking in society today?
Yes. I guarantee you it's lacking in society because I see these kids who are coming up, they don't care. It's just a job. It's a paycheck, and that's all they think about.
Well, I think we're missing something that's... what are the kinds of people that are always leaders?
Well, these are... What's that now?
What are the kinds of people that end up being leaders? What kind of personality do they have? Type...
Someone who would... self-confidence. It's, you know, somebody who believes that what they're doing is right, and...
I'm with him. I don't know where you're...
Well, I'd love to... That's what I like.
You'd love
liked.
To believe
I'd
that?
I'd love to believe that.
But you're cynical about it.
Well, I'm a type A personality, and the reason why I want to
I'm a type A personality. Okay, I got it.
So the reason why I want to be a leader is because, I was the type of person in school that wanted to be better than everybody else. If you're the leader, guess what? You get the gold star. You're automatically at the top of the heap.
Yes.
See?
Okay.
But then again, the followers are sometimes the ones who pay more attention.
A good follower is essential to success.
Right. Well, but then that follower...
Unless you're not a leader, you're not
Let's
alone.
Let Joe speak now,
well,
Joe.
Well, you're a leader of six. Bob's a leader of around six, I'd say, here.
Right.
Yeah. Oh, maybe we need to
you
hear...
You count my family if you want.
Who would be listening that would be the
biggest leader in our audience?
The biggest leader right now.
You wanted to go for who controls the most people.
Who controls the most people? Do you make something with your six people? Do you guys make a physical product?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
So yep.
Do you want to talk about it, or do you want to stay anonymous?
Well, I work for the government. And
is that product dropped on a larger number of people?
Yeah.
He makes bombs.
For people.
People, for people, for people, for blowing up people.
They're the luckiest people.
Yeah. Well, we make gear for the submarines and for the different trades.
Yeah.
Out here.
It's cool when you call it gear. It makes it sound like you could pick it up at REI.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, we make so much different stuff that is just...
So much stuff.
Yeah. Well, isn't that funny that he's military? That's, you know.
Mike, thank you very much.
I wouldn't
and by the way, we didn't ask for leaders to call. Mike just heard the discussion and said, well,
it's
talking about leaders. I need to be in there.
You know, Casey
exactly.
Casey asked, who's leader?
But you see, where we're differing, I think, is on motivation.
I think I agree. You're right. I agree that leaders are good and blah blah blah. But I just think that the drinking motivation
and blah blah blah, which is exactly what I did to her, by the way, when
and
she was doing her
write blah blah blah, blah, blah. Yes. Stone tablet.
I agree that you're type A and blah blah blah.
I'm Bob. I'm talking.
You know.
By the way, I hate that phrase type A. Do you know why?
Why?
Because it's such a constricting box. That I believe that type A, and I don't think you should allow yourself to be labeled with it, because I think that it's a box that weak people put stronger people in to try and actually contain them. It's like, oh, it's a type A personality. It diminishes what...
Oh, I think it's a great thing.
Like type A?
Yeah, I think it means that it sucks sometimes, but it means that you're motivated and you're do this, do that, and I think
I've got, just the way some people have a negative connotation of the word ego, which I happen to think is a beautiful word.
Shocking.
Some people, I think that type A means bouncing off the walls and not getting much done productively.
Really?
That's what it has come to mean to me. That's just linguistics, Joe.
I hate to label and categorize people. I think when you're dealing with types of people, you should really, it only applies to blood type. You might be type A, type O, negative, whatever.
That's a scientific fact as opposed to a box,
right,
to put different personalities in to try and control them.
Exactly.
And those classifications and characterizations are all subjective. That's all in the mind of whoever's making the analysis.
Right. Whoever's making the analysis may have a totally, just different interpretation of what
Absolutely.
It means.
Absolutely. I think why people become leaders depends on how they were raised. You, for example, think that you consider yourself a leader for the benefit of the herd.
Well, I read Kurt Vonnegut, which poisoned my mind with humanity.
Well, I think your parents got to you before Kurt Vonnegut did, and your dad, I had the rare privilege of meeting your dad on a few occasions, and even then you could tell the guy had other people's benefits in mind, other people's well-being in mind.
Oh, yeah. My dad was so honest that he got very upset with me for once starting to rip off the mattress tag that said, do not remove under penalty of law.
That's where you got your angle.
No, he was that crazy. I mean, my dad also found some money, the famous story I tell.
Right.
He found some money in a parking lot at a food mart on the way to a gas station.
Right.
And he picked it up, and he started walking around. Did anybody drop this $20 bill instead of just keeping it? And he said, well, I couldn't keep it because it's not mine.
So your need to lead came out of your dad's lessons to you.
Well, he was also a leader. He was the CEO and president.
Other people, though, other people like myself who were raised by someone who ran car dealerships, my need to lead from what small one there is all ego-driven. It's completely ego-driven. It's having a bigger desk than the guy next to you. Having more numbers up on the board than the guy over there. And while you may be a leading salesman, it ain't for the benefit of mankind. It's all about the science of your Schwanzen.
The what? I'm sorry?
Science of your Schwanzen.
Yes.
It's a whizzing. It's a whizzing contest to a lot of leaders.
Joe?
And my dad is a leader, but he's a leader through, what do you call it, attrition? Through doing the same thing really well.
Keep your head down and don't get shot.
Yeah, for a long time. And that's what I've learned.
I'd like to talk to some other leaders. Let's give out the phone number. Who's leading the most people in our audience right now? But see, that's what Spike wants to know, because for him it's all about the size of your fashion.
And for Hitler. And for
and I didn't, when you said that, I was like, I don't care who leads the most people.
And
who has some philosophy about their leadership that they would like to share? Did I mow all over you?
No, I'm talking quietly a little bit today, I guess. I need to yell more, I think.
I don't think so.
Okay.
Trust me. Ask Imus. What were you saying, though?
I don't remember. No, I talked about the little Schwanzen school of leadership, that's where your Hitlers come from. The need to prove to yourself that you're up there with everybody else.
1-800-252-1025. Teresa in Tacoma.
I turned into a leader because I was tired when I was younger of being told what to do, and I didn't feel that I was being led the right way or told the right way, so I learned how I could do it myself. And then the people that didn't want to take responsibility, that liked to just follow along, you know, I became management over them.
What? I understand the oppression of the youth, like, they're not doing it right, I can do it better. I like that.
Yeah.
And it started out as my own life, you know? And then I just...
Was it mom or dad or...
I didn't have a dad in my life, and my mom struggled to, you know, just for the two of us.
Mean place.
So when I was young, in high school and stuff, I was a very quiet person that no one noticed, and I went along with whatever anybody wanted to do, you know, and I didn't get in much trouble, but when I did, it was always somebody, you know, talking me into or following along. And I just, when I got out of high school, I got tired of it, you know, being told what to do and how to do it, and realized, you know, I do have a voice. And then I started doing it, and then other people that didn't really care, you know, I would start saying, okay, this is how you do it, and they were going, okay.
So you found it later in life, that power.
Yes.
Yeah. What motivates you?
Doing the thing right, the job right, you know, and then having people around me that they don't care. They're just like just getting the paycheck.
And for you, right is not like a moralistic thing. It's just like you see a floating bridge sink because someone left a manhole cover open, and you go, "What a moron!"
Right? Yeah.
You know, some of us have that in us.
Yeah. And what kind of?
You know, and then I just do it. I do a lot of things. I mean, I've had a car flip in front of me, and I just stop and take care of the situation because it has to be done. Somebody has to do it.
On the phone with us is a staff sergeant in Fort Lewis. Military leadership is an area we haven't even brought up yet. This all came out of discussing, folks, if you just joined us, Kurt Vonnegut, who passed away, one of the great writers of all time. And he said he felt that his goal as a writer was to catch people before they become generals, senators, presidents, leaders, and poison their minds with humanity. So we're investigating leadership a little, see where humanity fits there, or whether it's all about making the biggest sales number you can, or controlling people. Sergeant from Fort Lewis, Sergeant, we'll call you Sergeant D. What's going on?
Oh, good morning, Bob. First-time caller. Cluck, cluck.
You guys could go.
Oh, absolutely. Roger that. I don't know. I've got a lot of opinions on leadership and how to be an effective leader. What would be the best part you'd like to hear?
Well, if any of them you think, like Spike has sort of introduced, as Casey has, the idea there are different categories of leadership. There are leaderships with humanistic driving goals. Mm-hmm. Leadership, of course, involves power over people. And there are some that lead, try to lead by example and have people follow them. There are others who try to essentially fence in other people. There are others who believe that by selling the most, by having the most, they are leaders. From a military point of view, I'm wondering which of those you could relate to, and what you think military leadership is all about.
I've been in for 15 years, and to become the leader that I have become, what I've done is I've followed the examples of my previous leaders. And believe me, I've had a lot of them in the last 15 years. And what I've tried to do is to take the best points of each leader that I've had and
incorporate them into you.
Yeah, and make myself into that person. And what I'm trying to do is I always try to pass on those benefits to my junior enlisted soldiers.
Now, in a lot of professions, we have mentors and people in the media. In that case, for you, it would be like Gomer Pyle,
right.
And
high thought car.
But it's probably not TV people for you. What was it, Patton, though, in the movies, or what are the qualities of a great military leader? What are those things that you saw in those people that you said, "I want to be just like that"?
Oh, some of the greatest points is communication. Being able to speak clearly, and you just don't want to use those Wikipedia words because a lot of people have some trouble with the basic words. You want to make everything understandable. You want to be open to their communication, and you also want to be understanding.
Empathy.
Emphatic. If there's problems with the
family, emphatic and, is that's really loud, Sergeant.
Right.
Pile! That's emphatic. I meant empathetic.
Empathetic. Yeah. And really loud, yeah.
And loud. Emphatic and empathetic. They go together. Now, in other professions, a lot of people question their leaders. In the military, it is wrong to question your leaders. And in the military, don't you have to snuff those people? I mean, really put your foot down hard?
We try not to do that, at least in a negative way.
I know you're trying to recruit people for today's Army, but be honest. Come on.
Yeah, we try to improve people, but before we try to disprove that they're trying to say that we're wrong, we try to prove ourselves right, and we do that right in front of them.
Do you have you're about to order me to clean the latrine with a toothbrush voice? Can you issue me a really barking, stern command before
for my own good, of
course. For my own good before we hang up?
For your own good.
Yeah. Can you
order
me to do a bunch of push-ups or something?
Oh, you want me to give
you
a
This job? Is not a fetish I have or anything. I'm just curious.
All right. And I'm going to give this command to Bob?
Yes.
Private Bob?
Yes.
Attention.
Yes, sir.
Okay, you are at attention.
I'm at attention.
Now listen and understand the following order. You are ordered to pay respect to Casey at every given second of every show that you have.
Oh.
Number two, you will do 20 push-ups in the presence of Spike, and they will be correct. Back straight, arms flexed. Do you understand this?
I do, sir.
Roger that.
Don't call me sir. I work for a living. You call me sergeant.
I'll call you private.
It's always been my favorite line.
Sergeant, thank you very much. 1-800-252-1025. Leadership. What are the ingredients of leadership? And we're asking leaders in the audience.
You will listen and you will understand. Is that clear, Private?
Yes, sir.
You will wipe your posterior after ridding your body of unwanted materials. You will use 2 squares of government-issue toilet paper. Is that clear, Private?
Just 2, sir.
Just 2, Private. Understand what I say to you. When you are done, you will wash both your hands.
It would be better if I could have more than 2,
sir. 2 is what you've been issued, 2 is what you will use. Do you understand?
It's a big job, sir. All right, we're talking about leadership. If you just tuned in, Kurt Vonnegut passed away, one of the great writers, on the list of 100 best writers of all time, number 18, Slaughterhouse-Five, his biggest novel.
How old was he when he wrote his first book? Do you know?
Doesn't say. He was 84 years old. Surprised he lived so long because he smoked like a chimney. He did say that his motives in writing his books were political. He wanted to catch the people before they became generals, senators, and presidents and poison their minds with humanity. He wanted to improve humanity. And we thought we'd talk to leaders and see how much improving humanity is part of their motivation. Tim is in Renton. Tim, go ahead.
Good morning, Bob.
How are you today?
I'm pretty good. It's a nice day out. I think I'm going to enjoy it today.
Your thoughts on leadership?
Well, I think that there are basically 2 different kinds of leaders. There are the people that you've already described, the ones that seek out leadership for ego purposes. And then I think the other type of leader are people who have leadership, find themselves in positions of leadership without seeking that. And generally, those are the people that try to make the situation better for the people they're leading.
So you're more apt to have a deeper soul in humanity if you accidentally suddenly found yourself leading people and said, okay, how do I do this right?
Exactly. Exactly.
Whose quote was, "Have some people have greatness thrust upon them"? Remember that quote? That's the
I think it was Paris Hilton.
I think thrust was the word she used.
Oh, okay, no,
but I think
sorry.
You nailed it, yeah.
Yeah.
But that kind of summed up what you're saying. The best leaders, best leaders don't aspire to leadership. They have greatness thrust upon them.
Oh, and by the way, Kurt Vonnegut was 47 when he wrote Slaughterhouse-Five. It took him 24 years to finish it.
Wow.
Slow starter. Yes.
Although Cat's Cradle came out before that, he was 41.
So, but he was still, he was basically at a point in life where most people would not start a new career, especially one like that. David is in Seattle. David supervises 6 people. Why did you take the job, Dave?
Well, hey, morning, Bob. First-time caller.
First-time
listener. Nice to hear from everybody. You know, Bob, I work for Children's Services, and I oversee 6 social workers. And, before that, I was a line social worker for about 12, 13 years. And I had an opportunity to take on and be a supervisor and an administrator about 8 years ago. And the reason I took it was because in the job that I have, you can be an amazing agent for change in life in other people's lives in that position, and you can do it through the people below you by how you lead them.
How do you, in children's services, I assume people come to you with all sorts of problems.
Well, it's Child Protective Services, Bob.
Okay, so this is the thing. And by the way, do you ever get the nuisance calls from the kids who are really just trying to hassle their parents who found all out that there's a Child Protective Services and they want a later bedtime?
I know you talked to my kid two or three times.
Yeah.
Well, you know, we...
how do you weed those out?
Well, you know, it's a difficult thing, Bob, because, you know, by state mandate, you have to screen in everything, regardless if it's true or not, because they're allegations, and you have to weed those out through your investigations. So they're difficult cases, and of course, divorce cases are always difficult.
Right, but I
my
mean...
My dad says if I didn't go to school, I can't go and drink with my friends. Is that legal?
True.
My dad won't give me $20. Can you guys help?
It's child abuse!
But, you know, but the real part that we really deal with, though, Bob, is the true nature of the difficulties in people's lives, you know, especially around drug abuse and
right.
and just horrible child abuse that we do.
You guys do amazing work. Where does your funding come from?
Well, there's two sources of funding. There's state funding and there's matching funding from the Fed and it depends on, you know, yet there's certain criteria that to meet to make sure the Feds match your funding.
Do you say basically that the reason you're in it is primarily for human improvement?
Well, I think so. I think a lot of us that are in social work, you know, grew up in pretty difficult situations and wanted not to have that in our lives anymore and want to try to work that out with other people's lives and give other children a chance to have better lives. And I really do think that's a consistent pattern with a lot of social workers.
Yeah, I do too. All right, David, thank you very much. Great work you do. Let's look for some money-grubbing egomaniacs.
Power
so
and money.
Yes.
Somebody I can talk to.
I don't think we have one up there. They don't have time for us, you know. Christian is on the phone. Christian, go ahead.
Hi. Good morning.
Good morning, Christian.
I was a Bering Sea fisherman for about 16 years, and I started as on one of those big processing ships. When I first got on there, I was a processor, and I, you know, was doing some pretty miserable hard labor for long hours. And what ended up happening, and it happened pretty quickly, was that I got assigned a small section over about 7 or 8 guys, which I ran for a few contracts, and then after that, I ended up running even more sections and, you know, taking on more responsibility. And then there was times where I was running the entire factory as a foreman. You know, then you got like 60 guys underneath you, and offloads and backloads where you're running, you know, an entire crew and trying to get things done at a very high rate of speed for long hours, and it's a difficult job.
So you rocket shipped to the top. From the absolute bottom.
Well, yeah, it's not really to the top as far as you're not running a corporation or anything. But the bottom line is that in my mind, what makes people choose you as a leader, and then what makes you do well at it is first it's personal drive and attention to the detail, and then after that, it's understanding the people that are working for you. You know, when you're saying empathy, I couldn't say that. That's a big part of leadership.
It's my favorite word in the whole world, by the way, and my kids hate me for it.
Now.
Well,
but someday.
You know,
someday, maybe not.
It's just one of those things where you see some people that try to lead, and it's an ego-based deal. And when they do that...
Right. If it's just for you, people will turn on you eventually.
Yeah, and they'll wait for you to fall. They'll wait for you to fall down. And, you know, everybody human, you are eventually going to make a mistake at some point. But if you're kind to the people that are working for you and you try to make it as easy on them as possible, especially in a difficult situation, then when you do make a mistake, they will they'll probably help you rather than, you know, watch you go down. And I enjoyed it for a lot of years. That's basically all I wanted to say you know, being considerate to the people below you and having a very large attention to detail, and you will become a leader, generally speaking, in whatever you're doing.
Christian, I couldn't agree more. And the other thing I like that Christian said is the whole part about, I think the best leaders, we're grunts. We're absolutely at the bottom.
Okay.
You know, I still remember and daily the lessons of being the grunt at Dairy Queen, or my very first job, which was... selling apples at an apple stand called Hilltop Orchards, which is a huge business in my hometown. I mean, it sounds like a small thing, an apple stand selling apples.
Whole card table?
But
card?
All I had to get right was counting to 12. People would order a dozen of things. It was basically the whole job. It was the ears of corn, I remember, that did me in. It got me fired.
Yeah.
You know, and it was that sergeant who said, "Can't you count to 12?
I know you'll have to use both hands, plus."
So, having been a grunt and not being detail-oriented and precise, I knew I was a failure. And skulked away from being fired at my first job. I said, "I've got to fix this."
Wow.
My first job was Dairy Queen, and I went in there. I trained 1 week, and I was so good at grilling hamburgers, I rose through the ranks, and a week later, I was training a man.
Yeah. Mark, go ahead.
Oh, hi, guys.
You're a hotel manager, or your dad was a hotel manager?
My dad was a hotel manager.
What's the secret of leadership? We're running out of time. We want to get a little bit of everybody on. Go ahead.
All right. Well, one of the things that he said was that anybody, no matter how what their job is, what level their job is as important as everybody else. And he made a point to remember the name of anybody that worked with him. Waitress, maid, anything, and he would use their name and make them feel important.
Empathy.
Any chance he had.
All are equal, and I will tell you which ones of you are doing that properly.
not necessarily equal, but all are important.
But important, yes. Thank you. Susan, go ahead.
Yes, hi.
What is an effective leader?
Well, I'm in the nursing profession. I've been a nurse for 22 years. I work in the pediatric intensive care unit. I can do IV therapy, med-surg, and I'm a health supervisor. I think in the medical profession, what makes a great leader is experience, is good communication skills, but you're also giving a product. And if you take your leadership as a teaching tool, then you're going to make a better product, which is better nurses, which is better health care for the patients that you care for.
So you watch the hospital shows like the Grey's Anatomy. I mean, all of them.
I do not.
You don't?
I don't watch any of them, no.
They're all supposedly based on teaching interns. That's been the basic premise of a hospital show because
right.
I don't think the show would be interesting if it was just smart doctors.
Welcome to
it.
Competence General. No
you know
screw-ups,
what I mean?
No love affairs, no malpractice.
Watch them because they drive me crazy. It's like, that's not right.
You want to micromanage.
Can't put a Hefner valve on that guy's neck?
I know.
Please!
What are you doing?
Thank you, Susan. Joe in Tacoma, go ahead.
Hello.
Hi, you say there are two kinds of leaders. What are they?
Well, there's a leader that's secure in themselves, that has a lot of life experience, and leads by example, and follows the golden rule. And there are leaders who the opposite of that. They're insecure. They overcompensate for their insecurities and their shortcomings, and they withhold information. You know, they have a lot of knowledge, and they use that as power.
I just love the radio business.
Hail the weasel!
Hail the weasel!
My heart is palpitating. Thank you very much. Bridget, hello.
Hello.
You're on.
I am a teacher. And I've been listening to other people speaking as you've been interviewing them. And first of all, I'd like to say that leading should be beside the people that you lead, not above them. Because if you put yourself above other people, then right away you're not really a very good leader. We all have skills. We all have gifts that we need to bring out in each other. And leaders have the gift of bringing out those skills. But they don't put themselves above other people because, in my mind, there's only one above us, and that is the good Lord.
Thank you, Bridget. Beautiful, beautiful teacher statement. Next up is Pat. Pat, you have the last word on what makes for great leadership.
Excellent. Good morning, Bob and Spike and Joe, and of course, Casey.
Hi.
One of the things that I think leaders need to learn early on is how to lead without authority or how to lead without a title. I think if you can influence people without a title or without authority, you will find yourself in a leadership role and you will find yourself with a title one day.
Well, I don't know. What if you're the decider? I'm a decider.
I need a title.
No, I think what a lot of the other people said kind of falls into this is you have to be sincere and you have to care about the people around you and actually buy into their careers and not just your path and your aspirations, and strive to make those around you better. And I think
none of this describes the president.
Well, I was just thinking, Pat, thank you very much. To put a cap on it, basically, as you go through your day today and you see all the leaders in your life, now you'll notice the ones that you really admire, and you'll also notice the ones that shouldn't be leaders. Sorry to have ruined your day.
Paula Sala is a real Geico customer, not an actor. So to help tell her story, we hired that announcer guy from the movies.
When the storm hit, both our cars were totally underwater.
In a world where both of our cars were totally underwater,
we thought it would take forever to get some help.
But a new wind was about to blow.
With Geico, we had our check in 2 days.
Payback. This time, it's for real.
Geico. Real service, real savings.
You haven't seen Don LaFontaine starring in the movies, but you've heard him promote literally thousands of movies. Don has been doing voiceovers for 40-plus years. In addition to doing 5,000-plus movie trailers, he's worked for every major television network and the production studios. Nowadays, thanks to his Geico commercials, Don is becoming a famous face as well. Don, the voice, LaFontaine. Welcome to the Bob Rivers Show.
Thank you, Bob. Nice to be with you.
Nice to be with you. By the way, do you have a dorky voice, too, that you hide like I do? Or I don't hide mine.
How's that take? Was that good?
Yeah.
Well, yeah, that gets sort of gets that way when I'm with my children sometimes, I suppose.
Yeah. You do have, as we say in the biz, a glorious set of pipes.
Thank you. Thank you very much. I was lucky. My dad had a deep voice, and so did my mother. Hard to tell them apart.
You were bred for this work, then.
Yeah,
his and her shaving kits. So, did you know at a very young age that this was your calling? Did people tell you?
No, not at all. I didn't even consider it. I wanted to work in radio to a certain extent, but I didn't know what. I thought maybe I'd be a disc jockey or something. I suppose maybe to that extent, I thought that it would be helpful. Hmm. But it didn't. That wasn't the path that it took. I wound up being a recording engineer, a craft I learned in the service, and that brought me to New York, which brought me to a guy named Floyd Peterson, who was doing radio spots for movies, which was a new idea at the time. And so I started working with him. And one day a guy didn't show up, and I had to go do a scratch track, and there I am.
You know, much like Scotty the engineer, beam me up, Scotty, or you know, and all sorts of phrases. Bush Senior. What was his big phrase that the comedian made up?
Read my lips.
Read my lips.
Yeah.
With you, it's in a world.
Yeah.
Now, is that? I know that was real, but what's the first time you said it, and how many times have you really said it?
Oh God, I wish I had a nickel for. Well, actually, I do have a nickel for everything.
You have more than a nickel.
Yeah,
I could never tell you how many times I've said it, but it's well up in the hundreds, I'm sure.
So people want you when they hire you for In a World too. It's sort of like Get or Done for Larry the Cable.
They hire me to do what I've been doing for so many years. I think that's basically it. I'm lucky enough to have been around for such a long time that I'm fairly well known in this field. So. That's why they call me, I think. The term In a World came about back in the early 60s when we first started out. We were literally the first people in the independent trailer business. There's only about five or six of us all together. And we just discovered very early on that when you're doing a trailer, when you're doing a previous coming attractions, you're taking an entire audience and taking them into another world.
To a brand new world.
It's another time, and you have to establish very quickly what situation they are in, so you can get on with telling them the story. So those phrases were bred out of that need.
Hey, Don, do you ever feel guilty? Because you're the ultimate salesman when it comes to making movies a hit. And do you ever feel guilty when you come in and say...
You ever see one of your movies you promoted and said,
wow. You know, Ernest Saves Christmas 5. In a world where children don't believe in Santa Claus.
Right.
You ever feel bad to sell an absolute cramp sandwich to a buying public?
No, because...
Yeah, that's what he does.
It's the buyer beware, certainly.
Yeah.
And everybody's that way about their furniture or their cars. They should be that way about movies, too.
But I trust you. Also, in a car with a blown head gasket.
But also, it's a different strokes for different folks. There are some people who think Ernest Saved Christmas 5 is a wonderful family film.
That's exactly right. That's what I'm talking to.
I don't want that world.
Yeah, that's what I'm talking to. Those are the folks who attend the Pauly Shore Film Festival.
Some of the people I've met in our business that are legendary and have been doing it a long time and have, quote, the great pipes, they kind of went to the scotch and cigarette school of radio. They evolved that with some pretty hard living. Did you ever do much drinking or smoking?
I did both, but that certainly didn't help me at all. As a matter of fact, all smoking did was, you know, give me a little spot in my lung, and which is nothing serious, incidentally, but and made me clear my throat before every session.
Oh.
So I stopped smoking 20 years ago, and I don't drink to excess. I drink, you know, I'll have a couple of drinks on a weekend, maybe, but that's about it.
So what would you say your favorite piece of voiceover work would be out of all the years you've been doing this?
My favorite?
Yeah.
You know, I've been asked that question many times, and I never can come up with a proper answer because there's every time I think I have one, I think of something else. But recently, I have been extolling the fact that there was a film that I worked on when I was working at Paramount Pictures, The Elephant Man, which was a wonderful film. And that stands out in my mind because I wrote a script for the trailer based upon the script of the movie, which was the script that I had written was approved by the producer, Jonathan Sanger, before they shot a foot of film of the movie. Wow. And when we got the movie, we made one cut of the trailer, and that was approved. So it's got to be the most expeditiously produced trailer of all time.
We talk to a lot of actors that will do some huge blockbuster films, and then they'll do some smaller independent things for the love of the craft.
Right.
Do you do some trailers for the paycheck and some because it's a movie maybe you like and you'll give the guy a break? Or do you
have maybe the local PTA club wants you to do something for the school play?
I do quite a bit of that, actually.
You do? I'll bet.
Really?
Yeah.
Yeah, I do quite. I get requests for things like that on my website, and I try to be, you know, as Catholic about it as I possibly can. Sometimes I'm a little overloaded and I can't,
right,
you know, can't handle things, especially if they're on a deadline. But in particular, young film students and schools who are producing things and things like that, I do those as often as I possibly can. Yeah,
I've often heard you refer to as the voice of God, and you mentioned being Catholic. Have you ever read the Bible in a world I created?
Actually, I read Genesis for a friend of mine once. Excuse me, I had a little frog in my throat which refuses to croak. I read Genesis for a friend once, but no, I don't. I don't. Number one, I
do. You ever do parodies of your?
I think that Oprah probably has the voice of God.
Right, there you go. Do you? You of course are parodied often. Do you ever do any funny stuff? Like a movie about Mel Gibson getting arrested in the middle of the night or something like that.
Well, I've done some stuff. Ironically enough, I did for Family Guy. I did the trailer for the Passion of the Christ 2, which was sort of a takeoff on that whole thing on Mel Gibson and, you know, shooting up, and I think Jesus had guns in this thing or something. Yeah, I've been called upon to do that on a number of occasions, especially for someone who's leaving the business, retiring from the film industry or something. We do those
send-ups,
reels and things like that. Yeah, they call me a lot for
that. You would be perfect for a roast of just about anybody.
Yeah. Yeah.
Pablo Francisco, the comedian, he does a great bit about you, and he does actually a pretty darn convincing impression if you can't see him. Do you ever worry that he might go and, like, undercut you and just go and start doing movie trailers the same way you do them?
No. Pablo's a terrific young man, and he's a wonderful comic. The thing he does on me is only a small part of his routine, and I've seen him many times. It's very, very, it's very flattering. In fact, on one of my birthdays a few years back, a friend of mine did a roast film on me, and my wife and he went out and recruited Pablo to come in and pretend to be me on camera, and he did a wonderful job on it. I've never met the young man. I spoke to him on the phone many times, and, you know, imitation is the sincerest form of flattery, and I think it's terrific that he can do that.
Plus, if he did you, as opposed to parodying you, tried to pass himself off as you, he could be sued.
Well,
legally,
yeah,
he can't do that.
I would never do that. I mean, there's enough people doing that now. Why would I worry?
There are plenty of people do imitate you. There's no doubt about that. I can sort of get down there, but I don't. But I think people get down there in a phony. I mean, this is your real voice. We've been talking to you long enough now. If it was going to come up, the voice would have come up.
No, this is
who you are. Yeah. So it's really cool. What's undone for you? Is this do you have everything you want in life and this is great, or is there some challenge Don LaFontaine would like to?
Well, I've always been I'm sorry with this frog here. Sorry, I've always been very blessed and very lucky with everything that I've done. My life is a series of coincidences and chaos and unexpected things, and they've all been falling very right for me all my life, and so I've been very blessed there. There are very few things that I've left undone. One of the things I've always wanted to do, and maybe someday will, is to do Copland's Lincoln Portrait with the full orchestra. I don't know if you're familiar. familiar with that, but it's a beautiful piece of music on Lincoln, and with a narrator. And normally they get somebody like a senator or like
okay.
To do it.
Right.
Yeah.
Any Kennedy would do.
As opposed to that Michael Jackson Thriller narration.
Yeah, right?
Which is just a piece of pop music.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yes, Joe.
Some is there some stuff that you've refused to do or won't do? You say, yeah.
Well, I won't sell booze. I won't sell cigarettes. I won't sell porn.
Really?
And no.
In the world where the pizza guy really wants more than a tip.
Yeah.
You don't want to do that.
You don't want to do that?
That does have some promise, doesn't it?
It does. You'd be great for it. But no.
One thing that I really...
give you a piece of the back end, if you know what I'm saying.
I've told my my agents that the one thing that I will not do, I prefer not to do, is any of these shows on television, especially that have to do with things like Nostradamus or Edgar Casey or these predictions, you know, for the future, these dire predictions. The Mayans say the world's going to end, you know, when so on. I don't like doing that because I think it's irresponsible. I think that, you know.
By the way, you mentioned the top three things you won't do: booze,
cigarettes,
and porn, and then you forgot to mention radio. We're even further down the list.
I do radio.
Do you actually?
I'm not facile enough to do it every day.
Okay. Community service work.
That's right. Yeah. Don LaFontaine in Los Angeles. Don, the most amazing set of pipes on the planet.
Oh, thank you very much.
Thanks for being on. Cortezio truly is a leader in women. She's a woman living in a man's world. Rhea makes her living as a pro baseball umpire, and currently she's the only female in the sport. Perhaps you've heard of her. She's only 30 years old. She's yet to rack up the experience that would put her behind the plate of Major League Baseball games. Didn't she do an exhibition game, though?
Yes, she did.
All right. And she has... Here's her track record. It's so impressive, calling Double-A games, that they did call her up for a Cubs-Diamondbacks game in the Cactus League this year, and a full-time gig in the major league level, or minor league level. Well, actually, she can get to the majors?
Oh, yes, she can. She just needs to...
It could very well come before the end of the decade, which sounds like a tall ladder to climb. Rhea Cortezio, welcome to the Bob Rivers Show. How are you?
Pretty good. Thanks for having me.
Oh, thank you for being on, and congratulations. You are the first woman to actually call major league teams. Is that correct?
No, that's not correct.
It's not.
First in 20 years, though.
Oh.
Yeah, in 18 years. Pam Postuma, who is the third woman to umpire professional baseball. I'm the fifth out of six. But Pam was the third woman. She spent 13 years in the minors, 7 at AAA, 4 years as a AAA crew chief. And she worked 2 full major league spring training schedules in 88 and 89. And that was the last time that a woman had worked a major league exhibition game.
And why? Why? To me, the only surprise in this story to me really is why they aren't all women. Because women telling me whether I screwed it up or not is sort of my whole life.
that really is the story. You know, the day I worked that game in Arizona a couple weeks ago, there were probably a dozen minor league umpires that worked their first major league spring training game, and no one cares about any of them, but they've been driving me nuts ever since. But that is the story. Why haven't there been any women the past 2 decades, and why am I the only woman in professional baseball right now?
What's the answer to that, as far as you can see?
I have a couple theories.
Okay.
I mean, I don't see Major League Baseball doing anything to encourage women to either for girls to play growing up or for women to umpire, you know, that are adults. And as long as girls are forced into softball and not even given the choice to play baseball, you're probably not going to have many women officiating baseball.
So it starts at the grade school level in terms of which direction girls are steered, do you think?
I really think so, because I think if you go to any high school or college softball team and ask any of those girls if they even had the opportunity to play baseball or if they would have played baseball instead of softball given the choice, most of the ones I've talked to, in fact, I have yet to find a girl that, you know, dreamed of playing softball growing up. They all wanted to play baseball. They wanted to play in the big leagues. When I was little, I wanted to pitch in the big leagues, you know. No one baseball is a national pastime. Softball isn't. They're two entirely different sports.
Hey, Rhea, I respect what you're saying, but from the other side of that coin, has there been a softball player that could have played Major League Baseball?
I think so. I think so, and it's nothing to take away from softball players. And they've taken the sport to such a remarkably competitive level. But, absolutely. I bet if some of these top softball players had even had the opportunity, like Jenny Finch, if she had the opportunity to play baseball growing up, I mean, she throws, I don't even know how hard she throws, but she throws.
Could a woman be in the major league baseball league with men? That's another entirely different topic, but is that possible?
I'll tell you what, you know, yes, the average man is bigger and stronger than the average woman, but Major League Baseball is not for the average. It's for the extraordinary.
Ah.
And Phil Niekro is a firm believer that women, given the same opportunities and the same coaching, could play with men at the Major League level. And he probably knows better than anyone. He managed the Silver Bullets, which is a all-women's baseball team that barnstormed across the country in the 90s for about 4 years. And when he first got this team of women, you know, none of them had played baseball. They all had to play softball growing up, and it took a couple years to make the transition to baseball, which is an entirely different sport.
Well, they say that you are a very good umpire when it comes to, you know, calling people safe or out, balls and strikes, but there's more to being an umpire, especially at the major league level. You know, a guy like Lou Piniella or our manager Mike Hargrove
might get in your face.
Sometimes they get a little upset, and sometimes they get out there and literally will start bumping.
But can you get in my face and tell me what for?
Probably not from Jacksonville, but yeah, if we were in the same.
No, we could do it on the phone. This would actually be more of what I would really like.
The sergeant
was a little intimidating.
That's part. You know, if they acted like church mice out there, it would be boring. You know, every night it would be. I mean, ball strike, safe out, fair foul. That's.
Have you ever got face to face with a coach and told him what for?
Oh yeah, I mean, well, they have a very tight leash on us what we can and can't say. You know, it's not like the old days where we could say what was on our minds. We have to be very, very careful with what we say. But
hey, Rhea,
come out there and get in your face, and it's no big deal unless you have bad breath.
Well, you killed me. Now, I'm reading a quote from Lou Piniella here, and you worked the game between the Cubs and D-backs in exhibition play. And Lou Piniella said that he thinks it's great. He really does. There is a place for women in the umpiring ranks. But then in the next breath, he said, I pledge not to come out of the dugout and get in your face. I mean, that's kind of not giving you the opportunity to really do your job. If he's going to change how he manages because you're a woman, that's a double-edged, that's a slap in the face.
And that's true. And then, you know, this is almost like the argument as to whether women should be in combat.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Because and our sports are really based on, grunting men combating against each other for domination.
So I think Lou saying that probably did you more harm than good. Would you agree?
Well, you kind of have to take it in the right context. It's a spring training game. It means nothing. He probably wouldn't have come out on me anyway. I mean, how often...
Why don't you just call him a wuss here so we'll send him the tape?
Well, I think it's more of he's got the media jumping down his throat about some umpire that he couldn't care less about, and I think he was just, I don't know, nothing else, just blowing him off.
Now, umpiring's like playing. In the minor leagues, the money's not great, but a major league umpire, that is a good paying job, isn't it?
Oh, yeah, and that's part of the reason why there's no turnover at the major league level. It's the greatest job on earth, if you ask any of them.
How much do they make? I'm sure it must be public record.
You know, it's a lot less than the players. Explain to me how some, you know, the 25th guy on the roster can sit on the bench and make $200,000 a year or whatever, and a major league umpire out there working every single night makes, I think it's, I don't know, it's $60,000 or $70,000 is the starting salary.
And that's for the baseball season, right?
Right, for the entire season.
That's not, I mean, it's a good job, but I don't think that's a kick-ass amount of money either.
Well, that's 3 hours of work a night, 4 months a year.
Yeah, but you have to be sharp at what you do, Joe. You think an athlete only works for the game.
Getting paid to watch baseball.
Rhea, would you get in his face and kick some sand?
7 months straight. I mean, like for me in the minor leagues, I leave my house in March. I see my house again in September. I've got a big red suitcase, you know, full of all my clothes and... It's no way to live.
Rhea, I want to ask you what I've always wondered about umpiring. Two sides of it, two sides of the coin. First, the being really good at what you do. It seems to me, and sports are often about, as baseball especially, hand-eye coordination as well as athleticism.
Mm-hmm.
In your case, you do have to move around to see things. So you have to be athletic, and you are. I can see that. Your eyesight and your brain have to sharply, quickly register lightning fast things that most people sit there and go, I don't know what happened. And it's sure you're not drinking beer like us, but how do you train for something like that, or is it a gift?
I'd say mostly training, a little bit gift. Umpire school, which is the only way to get into professional baseball, is very intensive and covers, you know, just all the basics. I mean, it's 5 weeks long, 6 days a week, 10
Can you give me an example of something that where, like, the audience would think he was out, but you were trained to spot a telltale sign that he was safe, that sort of a deal?
Oh, let's see. Well, I had a play in that game with the Cubs and Diamondbacks where there was a steal at second, and the throw, you know, beat the runner. The throw was right on the money, beat the runner, but he didn't reach out for the bag. If he had reached out for the bag, he would have been tagged on the arm. He slid past the bag and reached behind the tag and touched the bag, and he was safe. And I think, you know, if you're just looking, oh, the throw beat him, he's out. You know, oh, what's that chick doing on the field?
That's the person I wanted to hear.
Yeah, baby.
Yeah, yeah. But, see, so you're trained, and you can be trained, to look for those three or four different things that might make him safe automatically, as opposed to the rest of us later go, what happened? And then we look for it in the instant replay.
Yeah, I mean, for one thing, if you slow down and pay attention, you know, you're going to see a lot of things that the average fan doesn't see. And if you know what you're looking for, and I think that's the biggest thing.
Yeah, that's umpiring school. Okay.
I mean, my brothers are the biggest Cubs fans, and my one brother called me after the game, and he said, oh, you missed a call. I'm like, what are you talking about? He says, anytime a pitcher throws to first against a Cubs runner, it's a balk. I'm like, oh, I forgot. Silly me.
No, you didn't miss that call, and you don't miss many. Most umpires don't. You guys are the pros, but you are human, and sometimes you do miss a call, and it seems like there's never a chance to reverse a call in baseball. Why don't we have instant replay, or at least why don't you umpires ever consider, when you know you've blown it, admitting it?
Well, that's not true. For one thing, instant replay, it just wouldn't work in baseball because you'd have to have, you know, four cameras on every base, and you couldn't possibly cover all the angles. It's all about...
Well, you can put a camera up and zero in on any point on the earth. You can look at my car from a satellite. I mean, I don't think the technology's an issue.
The technology would be pricey, and I think that the money that they could spend on that technology would
go to umpires.
On me.
Yeah. Well played.
Technology would be pricey, and also it's tradition in the game, isn't it? And it would slow the game. Baseball's already, I was going to say, baseball's already like a three-hour game or more sometimes.
Yeah.
You start throwing in coaches' challenges, and instant replay is going to get even longer. I wanted to hit the same issue, Rhea, but I wanted to ask you this. When you know, and you are human,
mm-hmm.
when you know you made a bad call,
mm-hmm.
what's the conversation you're having in your head?
Not that I could say on the radio, because I guarantee you there is nobody on the field, in the stands, and listening on the radio more pissed off than I am if I miss them. I mean, just, yeah. Because, I mean, I want to go out there every night and be absolutely perfect every night. I know it ain't going to happen, you know. So if I do, especially if I, oh, yeah.
Yeah.
I think of a couple situations in the past 9 years where I've missed something where it's just like, what the, was I thinking?
So you're having this in your head, but at the same time, the dignity of the sport requires that you maintain your stoic, beef eater-like impenetrability mm-hmm. to the people from outside, no matter how angry they are at you. On those rare occasions when they're right, you have to just sit there and take it. You have to have a thick skin.
Yes and no. I mean, there are situations where we can fix it. And I had one, a couple years ago where, I'm not even going to give you the play because it was just that bad, but I kicked it, and before I could even... You know, I mean, here I am still cussing myself out in my head, and the manager is on top of me, and half of his dugout is on top of me, and this guy is about 6'4", and I'm actually pushing him off of me, and he's screaming at me, and I'm screaming at him, you know, just a minute, and we'll fix it, you know, because I knew I was, he didn't have to say anything.
Right. Oh, so you're offering we'll him a make it. Good. Well, I'll call
no,
one.
No, we'll get to the make good question later. Let her finish.
What's that?
No, keep going.
Oh, yeah, so we fixed it. And I managed somehow, through some miracle of the Lord, to get out of there without any ejections on it. But it's, you know.
So you did fix it. You changed the call. And that'll happen. If it happens, it has to happen real quick, I've seen in a game.
Oh, yeah. I knew as soon as I put the wrong arm up that, yeah.
All right. Now, thank you. Thank you for that, because most umpires won't share. This is good. We should have more women umpires.
It does not happen often.
I respect that. Now, but let me ask you the other thing, because as fans, just about every fan believes, and Joe was jumping on that, that when an error is made or when a close call goes away, maybe it could have gone either way, that an there's a phrase for it, everybody uses it, you know it, later, maybe in a next play, maybe in the next at batter, one goes the other way, and all of us sit there on the couch and say, well, that was a make-good call. That made up for the last one the ump was
that, gave. I mean, maybe they do that in Little League or T-ball, but there's no make-up calls in professional baseball. I mean, if I miss a call or whatever, if I'm behind the plate and I miss a pitch, I'm not going to miss the next one. I've missed two, you know.
Sorry, you won't give one to the other team.
But if you're calling first base, then Ichiro is just, you know, it's almost a tie, but he's out one time, and then the next time it's too close to call. You don't give him the benefit of the doubt since you called him out on the first one?
There's no benefit of the doubt.
No benefit of the doubt. He's tough.
Hey, Rhea, I was raised in Baltimore, Maryland, and watched Earl Weaver just abuse umpires my entire youth. I watched the Earl just go after these guys. It was a sport. It was entertainment. It's what the crowd wanted to see. I can't imagine him going after a lady. I just couldn't.
And what about the fans who say really mean things to umpires? Have you had that happen to you?
Oh, yeah. I mean, we all know fans are idiots. They don't know what's going on. And
thank you.
And every ballpark has the same kind of people, the same characters, I guess, in every ballpark. And the loudmouths, they're, you know, and I've worked thousands of games in professional baseball. The loudmouths are all, you know, middle-aged, overweight, white men.
Uh-oh.
Ding, ding, ding.
Hey!
You know,
is this television? How do you see us?
I'm not saying all middle-aged, overweight white men are losers like this. But
all losers are middle-aged, overweight white men. Right. Good call.
Good. That's good, Rhea.
You know what, to be on that field, you know, they're so just insanely jealous of anyone that's, you know.
It's like you know me.
Yeah. Hey, Rhea, that's the safest group. You can say anything about that group in America. They have no recourse.
Know how to drive.
Thank you.
Rhea Cortesio, what a pleasure. I hope you're in the majors next year, and I would love to see you at Safeco Field.
I would love to be there.
All right. Be well.
Thanks a lot.
State lawmakers spent a good deal of time talking about sex yesterday. And here's what they were dealing with. Sex ed. A bill requiring public schools to teach, listen up, both abstinence and contraception in sex education. It has cleared our very liberal state legislature, I suppose, right? Isn't that what you would say?
Well, I guess it's liberal.
You're not going to have that down in your neck of the woods where you grew up.
I don't know. It seems like common sense to me.
To me, it seems like common sense, too.
And I was surprised that there were some legislators speaking against it.
The bill passed by a 63-34 vote after a four-hour debate. It was approved by the Senate and now goes to Governor Gregoire, who is expected to sign it. The practicality of how this works, I guess, is they must tell you about birth control pills and other contraceptives, in addition to saying, probably a good idea if you don't have sex.
And from what I understand, it's not a requirement that you teach about sex at all. But you used to could say, if you were going
to
have
you
a class.
You used to could say.
Before, well,
it's a great sentence.
And you still could.
And then you go to English class.
Until this bill is passed.
You used to could say in school.
You still
can. I
don't
think you could ever speak like that.
You could say, okay, you young folks, we're going to talk about sex. And what we're going to tell you is don't do it. Okay, that was it. That's the class.
No, come on. They've always had biology, our bodies, ourselves kinds of classes, haven't they?
They didn't always have that. And
wait a minute, I had it when I was in school.
Me too.
I had it too, but...
Oh, hey, who didn't have it in the show?
Well, they're making it a law now, so obviously it hasn't been the rule.
So now what the law will be is you can say, okay, you kids, we're going to talk about sex, and what we're going to say is don't do it, but if you don't listen to me and you do it anyway, let me tell you about these things.
The only way to absolutely prevent pregnancy and avoid sexually transmitted diseases is to abstain from sex, says Representative John Ahern from Spokane, a Republican. He says, that's guaranteed. If you don't have sex, you don't get pregnant.
No problem there, he's
right.
Seems
to me that abstinence education should be the core of our sex ed curriculum.
I think he's right about that.
I think it should be the hardcore
it
of our
be,
sex ed curriculum.
It should be, you know, priority one. Don't Job do it. One. There's no question about that. But right. There's another representative there from the big town of Republic that I think is, you know.
Mary Lou Dickerson from Seattle said, "Ignorance is not bliss. I grew up going to schools that chose not to teach sex ed, and I confess right here that until I went to college, I actually thought that girls could get pregnant by sleeping next to boys." Until college?
Yeah.
It's
yeah.
quite the admission to yeah. make in front of all of your colleagues.
I think that's great.
Do you?
Yeah, let's yeah. teach that.
Okay. And let's teach rain to fall upward, especially during the flooding season.
That yeah. hand-holding, that could do it. Right
I'll bet
there
are a lot of people who would agree with that statement on the, in the audience, that thought women who thought that. If you're a woman who thought you could get pregnant by just sleeping next to a guy, 1-800-252-1025. I want to see if you're out there.
And you just can't figure out how little Ricky was made with Lucy and Ricky sleeping in separate beds.
How did that happen? Yeah. I'll bet there's a few.
Yeah. I'm happy that that Planet Earth show is on right now because it shows, I mean, it's given a basic outline to my daughter, because I haven't had any talks
about
it. Is
it showing animal sex?
Well, it's showing mating, you know, a little bit.
How is that not sex, by the way? Why did you veer away from that word?
Well, it's they're not doing it for fun. They're doing it, you know, to propagate.
You don't think animals enjoy it? I think that's the whole, that's why we're programmed to enjoy it, is for procreation. Don't you?
Well,
it
I
really
think,
looks like the female animal has a whole lot of fun.
I my think, house either.
I think if they enjoyed it, they'd do it more often. I think most of the, because there's only
they
one
would have a whole city with glittering lights right. to do it in. And whatever the animals did there would stay there.
Right. I mean, it's usually like one season where they get the urge and they
do it. You
don't
think it. Animals enjoy sex? Well, you're honestly saying that.
Do they look like they're enjoying it?
Yes, I think they love it as much as we do.
No.
You know, to other species, we don't look like we're having fun. It's, that's why they call it the monster. Monster with two backs.
Humans have things to get us in the mood. Animals don't have anything to get them in the mood.
They have spring.
Oh, they have.
The, yeah, those yeah. drums from the village.
And they have beautiful feathers. I mean, they have dances. They have
mating rituals, everything. I think animals have as much fun as we do.
I want you to watch a video of a male lion walking up to a female lion and say, "Now's good."
That's the way she likes it.
Bite her in the back of the neck. Hold her on the ground.
She asked for it. She wasn't wearing anything.
Works in my house.
But you should see the mating ritual of the birds of paradise. I mean, it is beautiful. They have this beautiful yeah. flowers, and they do these dances. And
you see that Happy Feet movie? There's this call, this love call that these parents make, you know, and then they find they hear this call, and it's yeah. it gets
it's
them
music
all,
to their
the
ears.
Juices going. Yeah.
But
oh, you have that puritanical. It's painful. It's a kind of an evil sort of a thing.
I think humans enjoy sex quite a bit. I have a hard time believing animals enjoy. It.
And maybe it's because we don't teach animals contraception.
We should
they
teach
don't
people about
more.
Animal sex. She was going through the whole... That's what The Lion King was about, really, right?
Yeah.
The whole family structure of animals,
oh, yeah,
the love
yeah,
between
yeah.
them.
Yeah.
Ruth is in Kenmore. Hello, Ruth.
Yeah, hi. We were at Woodland Park Zoo on Mother's Day last year, and the tigers were doing it. Quite a bit.
Nice.
And I had to explain what they were doing to my 7-year-old son, which was really hard. But then in December, there was a baby tiger born, so that was easy.
So you were able to say, "Hey, the zoo has a baby tiger, let's go see it," and explain to him the miracle of contraception, of birth, not contraception,
yeah,
obviously.
Yeah, really.
And even conception.
Good time.
Huh?
Both tigers were having a good time.
So they enjoyed themselves.
You
yeah.
saw the baby tiger being conceived. I mean, that's even
right.
more special than seeing the tiger.
Why do you think guys buy a Jaguar to get women?
Okay.
Ruth, thank you. Eddie is in Puyallup. Eddie?
Hey, guys.
You're on.
Hey, my daughter had done some research on this subject and had told me that dolphins are the only animals next to humans that do it for pleasure.
Was that a research, like, is she in college?
Oh, no, no.
Or is that, like, see and speak? Is that playtime at the
dolphin nursery? Goes,
No, yeah, she said that dolphins are the only other animals on the planet.
Really?
Pleasure, other than humans, yeah.
So the rest of them, it's just a sort of a...
Procreation only?
Almost like taking a...
pretty much instinct. And
I don't buy that. Eric, what do you see?
No, it's not true at all. In fact, one specific species of ape, the bonobos, for example, use sex for all kinds of reasons. Some of it pleasure, some of it domination in social situations, and sometimes just no reason at all.
Right, and don't the deer and elk, like, rub on trees and stuff just because, like, my dog humps the furniture?
That's usually done for dominance purposes and to demonstrate the prowess in various ways.
All right, Katie is in Bellevue. Katie, go ahead.
Yes, my sister and I were raised in the church with my family, and we have, of course, had to read all the Old Testament where it said, from the seed of Abraham, so-and-so begat so-and-so, that type of thing.
Right.
And so she admitted recently that when she was young, she was taking a bath one day, and she looked down and she saw, like, a sesame seed stuck to her leg from lunch, and she thought, oh, my God, I'm pregnant.
She thought
the seed of my sandwich.
Somebody's seed was left in the tub.
Oh, my God, the Mary Cheese and I are going to have a baby.
Thank you, Katie. No, by the way, you're the only one who called to talk about someone else. No one else had a severe sexual misconception. At least that they're willing to admit to.
Right.
I remember all that stuff, too, before I knew what it was.
Yeah.
I don't know. Nothing. And that's weird, because I suspect that nature would... Let's say we didn't have language and we couldn't speak to each other.
Uh-huh.
We could just grunt,
right?
Which is all we really need if you get down to it. Nature would teach you, right? You don't really need someone to tell you how to... I bet no animals...
That's exactly the structure of this story you're reading. Joe said the vote went 64 to 30, was it 37, something like that, 64 to 36?
Yeah.
So almost one in three legislators in this state thinks that if you don't tell a kid about sex,
they won't have it.
The thought won't cross their mind.
Right. And it won't until much later, which is when it should.
Or when somebody introduces it to them and they don't know what to do about it.
Well, but you just keep a close eye on them.
Uh-huh. Yeah, at a closed door. And you feed them under a slot in the bottom of it.
I understand the whole keep it from them as long as possible mentality. I do.
That hasn't worked.
You're kidding.
Now in the days of an internet connection, it might not work as good as it used to.
Right.
Katie, thank you. Amanda, go ahead.
Hello. I just want to let you know that I love my parents so much, but they didn't speak a word of any of that to us. So there's five girls in my family. We didn't know anything about that until high school.
Nothing about sex at all. As far as you were concerned, it didn't exist?
Not really. Well, I thought, like, making out was pretty cool, but I had no idea there was, like, you could do anything after that, really.
That was it?
And then my friends, like, are like, yeah, you know, so-and-so got pregnant. I'm like, what? How did that happen?
I didn't know she was Catholic.
No, I'm not Catholic. No, I'm
I didn't know she had a sesame seed bun. No, seriously, we're a weird animal that way. Yeah. And I suspect that the root of the conservative viewpoint on this, uh-huh, by the way, and I see both sides, is that we're thrusting this on them way too young in our culture, and that you're supposed to be ignorant and innocent for a long period of time.
Yeah, but if you ever turn on your television or watch a movie...
That's my point.
Or talk to other kids.
Yes. But that's kind of sad in a way.
I agree.
Whereas you're saying,
so arm
them. You're saying, well, you're 2.5 now. Here, just in case you need
it's
these.
It's time. Elmo, not a good guy.
Amanda, thank you.
You're welcome.
Anybody else brave enough?
Wow.
We are, if you think about it, in nature, mm-hmm, we won't know what it is until an appropriate age in nature. Except for our media and communications and things like that.
The problem is our human biology, an appropriate age is 12, 13 years old.
Well, that's thanks to hormone-laden milk.
Right. Well,
it does a body good.
I think it's always been that way, or at least for a long
time.
No,
it's been changing dramatically. Right.
Well, hundreds of years ago, people used to get married at 12 and 13.
Yeah,
that was very common.
Yeah.
Hundreds of years ago.
And we've extended artificially childhood. That's what
changed. Tell me about it. To about 25. Kate, go ahead.
Hi, I'm Kate.
You're on. Go ahead.
All right. I am a teacher, and the problem is that a lot of our kids, when we do teach this in the spring, they know everything already. And it's not necessarily from their parents. It's from older brothers and sisters. It's from TV. It's from internet, everything.
Right. And I agree with you, but is that necessarily good?
I think they need somebody to teach them the actual facts because they get so confused, they don't know the difference, and they're experimenting a lot earlier than they used to, and if they don't know,
that means if we're going to officially have government teach sex, we actually need to decide what sex is. I mean, if you, I don't know if you've been around the block a few times, or but a lot of people are into some pretty freaky things. Should the government limit it to, you know, bread and butter? Or should the government introduce all sorts of
little jam,
freaky things,
little marmalade?
Well, yeah.
Well, they need to be able to know what the consequences are, because we get unwanted.
But once you open that consequence door,
well, what this
how
bill,
far do you let them in? If you know what I mean.
What this bill says is, if you're going to teach them.
Which
the
door do you let them in? Several doors.
Gosh. Teach them the whole course. I mean, you give them the full.
What do you tell children? Okay. To me, it's totally unnatural to have government involved in this at all.
Well,
I actually think it should all be family. Of course, I'm living in a fairy tale dream world. I know. I just don't want the government.
Did you have a chat with Wally today here?
That's right.
I noticed his girlfriend's put on some weight lately.
Becky is in Auburn. Becky, hello.
Hi. Good morning.
Good morning.
I would just like to say that I think it's really important to be simple and correct, especially when they ask questions. And even be anatomically correct, however hard that is.
Use the slang language?
Well, yeah. When my kids were little, about third grade, one night at dinner, my son asked me where babies came from. So I told him the fluffy story of coming from heaven, and he looked at me, and he's like, really, Mom, where do babies
come from? Come on, come on.
I had to say, okay, well, you know,
right,
I correct terms of the body, and that was it. So.
And he's fine with that.
Yeah, they are. They really
Sometimes we forget the children are the same species as us.
Yeah, yeah.
We're headed for the same things. Yeah.
Crazy people that we are. But they're open to honesty and simpleness.
But and I know I'll be the lone duck on this show when I worry about the school basically handing out contraceptives and doing all of that. And I know there's so many instances you can point to of, you know, abused kids or kids that are in tough situations and need. I wish there was a clinic for them to go to away from school. Oh, there is, isn't there? And that the government would stay out of, tell them to, like, stop, don't do it.
Right.
If you do it, here's a pamphlet, go somewhere, go to a church, go, you know what I mean? If you can't go to your own family, which is too bad.
It's a health issue, and it should be dealt with by the health administration, not the education department. Is that kind of what you're saying? It's a clinical job and not a classroom job?
It's a family issue.
Oh, I'll give you that.
And you don't have them get involved in the rest of families raising of kids unless it becomes an emergency.
Right.
If it becomes an emergency, then you got to do something.
Yeah, you guys are kind of breaking up. I'm sorry. I wish I could hear everything you were saying.
Becky, we have this transmitter. Go check it out. Lori in Snohomish.
Good morning.
It's
I grew up in a conservative family. My parents had a whole different perspective. We learned about sex at a very young age. They talked about it all the time. They advocated abstinence and told us why, but they didn't keep it a big secret, and we all understood it. And I think it was a better way to go.
Yeah. Like car toys.
Yeah, there's no doubt abstinence is the number one best way. It's the surest, safest.
You betcha. You're going to teach your daughter abstinence, Joe.
Oh, yeah. I'm going to demand it.
But you're a liberal. Shouldn't you be teaching her where the really cool websites are?
Well,
where you can see the really freaky stuff?
No. But what you should be teaching her, I think, is also this is what happens with abstinence, and it's perfect. But if you don't abstain, you know,
your mother has something for you in the top drawer.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, what if, I mean, it's like fire safety. Obviously, you want to say don't have fires. That's the safest way to go. But if your house catches on fire, you need to know how to get out safely.
So if your pants catch on fire.
Yeah, stop, drop, and roll one on.
Your crotch gets hot.
Stop, drop, and roll one on. I'm telling you, it's what kids need to know.
Thank you. Tom?
Yes?
Speak up.
Well, my concern is, we teach, sex education, and they say how a man and a woman get together and the seed and all that. But what they don't tell you is the pleasure that two people enjoy when they have sex.
They don't need to.
You want the government to talk about pleasure?
Yeah, I don't
Let's
want
Let's start
to,
doing it at motor vehicle
I
department
don't,
first.
I don't want to encourage
I'm Bill
the pleasure.
Clinton, former president of the United States. I'd like
he could
few,
do those PSAs.
I'd like a few minutes with your children, please, if you leave the room. Thank
part
you.
Of the sex education, though, the pleasure that people get, I mean, shouldn't that be?
I'd like to make them think it's kind of hard, not all that much
yeah,
fun.
Yeah, it's not that much fun. This is the whole Catholic thing.
Yeah, let them figure the pleasure
It's really
out.
Annoying, but we have to make a baby once in a while to keep the species going. All right. Eric was doing a little more research about the difference between animals and humans, and there is one major notable difference.
Oh, absolutely. When we were talking about whether or not animals like sex, they are primed for it at certain times of the year. They're basically in heat.
They're like the Vulcan, Spock, who only came into heat at a certain time.
Right,
and
right.
The rest of the time he looked at all of the other humans as annoyed and... with that annoyed look
yeah, oh, yeah.
that they were being ruled by
an
their
emotional
emotions.
Waste of time.
That's exactly right. And during those times where they are primed, it's like they've already gotten the champagne and the berry white and the chocolates, and they don't need that romantic dinner out. But humans, on the other hand, are always in a sort of low grade of heat. And to bring them to the forefront of that, that's why you need all those other accoutrements.
Accoutrements?